Hello, I'm Steve Gillen, historian for the History Channel. The tragic death of President John F. Kennedy 40 years ago is one of the greatest mysteries in American history. This episode, The Guilty Men, examines yet another theory that President Lyndon Johnson was involved.
I know, as attorney for Lyndon Johnson, that he murdered John Kennedy. He murdered John Kennedy to become president and to avoid prison. And there is no doubt in my mind.
You can't kill the President of the United States unless the next president, the head of the FBI, and the head of the Secret Service are in on the cover-up.
I'd like the entire world to know how I personally feel is the fact Lyndon Johnson knew about the assassination and was a part of it.
Deep in the heart of Texas lie buried some of the darkest and most well-kept secrets that tell us who killed John F. Kennedy in Dallas on November 22, 1963, and why. Those forces of darkness revolved around one of that state's most famous political sons, Lyndon Baines Johnson. Born in 1908, he grew up in a comfortable middle-class home in Johnson City. At an early age, Lyndon showed a keen interest in politics. From the beginning, he was driven by a determination to win, whatever the cost.
In a word, he was ruthless. There wasn't anything he wouldn't do to get what he wanted, regardless of what it was. And probably the best example would be in 1948 when he was running for the Senate. And he was running against a man named Coke Stevenson. And the election was very, very close, a very small number of votes, which forced a recount. And once they did the recount, they found out a 201-vote error in a little place called Alice, Texas. And eventually they found out that the 201 votes had been added, one for Stevenson, 200 for LBJ. As a result, he won by 87 votes, and he was nicknamed Landslide Lyndon.
But the real name, the name used in the backwards that didn't appear in the newspapers, was Lion Lyndon. And that stuck with him the rest of his life.
That rigged ballot became the template for a political career based on bribery and corruption. The full extent of Johnson's criminal activity only began to unravel 11 years after his death. In 1984, at this courthouse in Franklin, Texas, a former Johnson business associate, Billy Solestes, appeared before a grand jury.
According to Billy Solestes, there were 8 murders perpetrated on the part of Lyndon Johnson. The first name was a man named Douglas Kenza. That was followed by a number of men involved in Estes' businesses who were corrupt, and they were all killed with carbon monoxide. Josepha Johnson's name is listed on this Justice Department document. That's Lyndon Johnson's sister. So Estes is accusing the Vice President of the United States of murdering his own sister. And the 8th name listed is the President of the United States, John F. Kennedy. And then there is a promise of knowing more. And if Billy Solestes is telling the truth, and there is every reason to believe he is, it gives you an idea of the depth of the corruption and the ruthlessness of Lyndon Johnson.
According to Estes' written testimony, that murderous cycle began in 1951 in Austin, Texas, at this downtown golf course known as Butler's Pitch and Putt. The killer was a Johnson henchman called Malcolm Wallace.
Malcolm Wallace was born and raised in Texas. He was Texas-bred, Texas-educated, a very intelligent man. And when he graduated from the University of Texas, he was evidently recruited by Lyndon Johnson, and he was given a job at the Federal Department of Agriculture.
John Douglas Kinzer, the golf pro at Butler's Pitch and Putt, was having an affair with Wallace's wife and with Lyndon Johnson's sister.
Lyndon Johnson's sister, Josepha, was an alcoholic. She was a drug user. She was sexually promiscuous. She had loose lips. And who knows what she might tell Kinzer or others about Lyndon Johnson's political shenanigans.
Malcolm Wallace walked into the Pitch and Putt golf course in Austin, Texas, and shot to death in cold blood John Douglas Kinzer.
Kinzer died here for his indiscretions, Wallace was soon arrested and went on trial in Austin 3 months later.
First-degree murder, open and shut case. He gets a lawyer known as a Lyndon Johnson lawyer. So Lyndon Johnson is going to do his best to get his friend out of hot water.
During that trial, Lyndon Johnson took a room at a local hotel, and the 10 days that that trial was going, constantly sent runners from the hotel to the courthouse to bring him word of what was going on during the trial. So he followed the pulse of the trial very, very carefully.
Malcolm Wallace is found guilty of first-degree murder, but through influence of Lyndon Johnson, Malcolm Wallace receives a 5-year suspended sentence. Lyndon Johnson was able to get his man out of first-degree murder.
Much of the control Johnson exercised was acquired through an early alliance with a fellow Texan. Edward Clark gained unrivaled power in the late 1930s with a series of high positions in the state government. He became Johnson's lawyer and a formidable ally throughout his career.
The power Edward Clark exercised covered almost every avenue of government power in the state of Texas. He would make sure that important appointments were covered by his men. The judge's control was through their vote. I mean, he had their decision in the palm of his hand. And this was, of course, important because Austin was the capital of the state. And anything that happened legally went through Austin, and that meant it went through Clark. He was known as the secret boss of Texas. He could, and did, arrange for people to be killed. He arranged for money to be laundered. He had that control.
This building in downtown Austin became the headquarters of Edward Clark's all-powerful law firm. Barr McClellan was recruited as a young lawyer in 1966, 3 years after the assassination, unaware of the dark secrets hidden within. Soon after joining, in an after-hours conversation with John Coates, one of the firm's attorneys, Barr was made privy to an astonishing piece of information.
Coates and I started talking, and in the course of it, John told me, if the truth be told, Clark arranged the assassination of Kennedy. It was a kind of statement that you can't easily forget, even though I personally chose not to believe it at the time. It stuck with me. Attorneys know they're acting behind a privilege. They can say things to each other. And this talk would go on at after-hours drinks, at Christmas parties, just traveling on the road. And it was like Johnson had to get Kennedy out of the way. I worked closely with Don Thomas, and Thomas was the business attorney to the president and was the second man in the law firm. Thomas and I did a number of cases together, and we traveled the state because he did not fly. We'd been to Dallas one day shortly after I became partner, and it was driving back, and just out of the blue, it seems now, looking back, that Thomas said, "I am the only living man who knows what happened in Box 13. And we know what that meant. That was the stolen 1948 election. I didn't say anything. Sometimes it's best just to listen. And then he looked away and added, "But Clark took care of things in Dallas." At that point, what I'd been hearing in the law firm, what John Coates had first told me, I knew it was true, because this came from a man that was Johnson's business attorney, one of Johnson's most trusted confidants, a man who worked very closely with Johnson during his maturing years, his growing up years, so to speak, and as president. And when I heard that, there was no question but that Clark had been behind the assassination. And he'd done it for Johnson. I know beyond a reasonable doubt that Johnson murdered Kennedy. He acted through Clark. He saw that it was done, and he did it out of a corruption of power that is unequaled in our history.
After becoming a senator in 1948, Johnson developed an unrivaled power base in Washington, using his forceful personality, political skills, and corruption. He established himself as one of the most influential men in the nation, but as vice president to Kennedy, he lost much of that authority. By 1961, his past was catching up with him. In Texas, Henry Marshall, a local agricultural official, had begun investigating one of Johnson's illegal sources of funding. Working out of these offices in Bryan, Texas, Marshall had become aware of Billy Solesty's misappropriation of federal cotton allotment funds. Attempts to buy off Marshall had failed, and his investigations were beginning to threaten the vice president himself.
Billy Solesty's became worried, Lyndon Johnson became worried, and some of them got together and decided, what are we going to do with Henry Marshall? So on one particular day, according to Billy Solesty's, Cliff Carter, an aide to Lyndon Johnson, the Vice President of the United States, and Malcolm Wallace got together. And finally, Lyndon made the statement, get rid of him.
On June the 3rd, 1961, Henry Marshall failed to return home. An extensive search was made of the family farm near Franklin, Texas. His only son, Don, was 11 years old at the time and remembers that day well.
My uncle found him on the second attempt when he went out to the place. He was in a very remote location, probably about 3/4 mile off the road.
My mother had this stone placed here in order to mark the spot. The truck had blood around the sides of it. The side on the passenger side had a dent in the fender behind the passenger door. And that's apparently where my father's head was knocked into the side of the truck, and he had his eye damaged at that point. There were a number of yaupon bushes that had been broken, and the gun was laying beside the body, and pretty much nothing else could be seen except signs of a struggle.
Local officials immediately ruled it a suicide, despite overwhelming evidence to the contrary.
He had been shot 5 times with a bolt-action rifle. He had enough carbon monoxide in his lungs to cause him to pass out at the time he died. There was no effort made to collect any evidence or preserve the crime scene. They had pretty much determined in their minds that this was going to be a suicide. When Billy Saul Estes testified before the grand jury in Franklin, he implicated Cliff Carter and Malcolm Wallace as the people that were most involved in my father's murder, Wallace being the trigger man and Cliff Carter being the one who arranged for the murder. I'm firmly convinced that Malcolm Wallace was the killer of my father. Who that would have aided, probably political power behind everything. Johnson would have been aided more than anyone else.
The grand jury concluded Henry Marshall in 1961 was murdered, which means in simple language that the grand jury believed Billy Saul Estes when he told them that Lyndon Johnson had ordered Malcolm Wallace to kill Henry Marshall.
But Johnson's dark dealings were not confined to Texas. In late summer 1963, one of his long-term partners in crime was about to be exposed for corruption by a Senate investigation.
Bobby Baker was the secretary to the Senate majority. Basically, he was the secretary for the Senate. And he was one of Lyndon Johnson's closest associates. And everything that Lyndon Johnson wanted to perpetrate, he had Bobby's help. Essentially, if somebody wanted to get a military contract and they wanted influence of Lyndon Johnson to help them, they had to pay off Bobby Baker, who would then pay off Lyndon Johnson. It's the world of bribes. Bobby Baker was involved in a call girl service. He was involved in real estate scams. He was involved in dealings with organized crime. He was in dealings with oil men, particularly Clint Murchison, an oil millionaire from Texas. So as a result of all this, Bobby Baker was in big trouble. And with a little bit of inspiration on the part of the Kennedys, if they could get Bobby Baker to talk, Lyndon was all done. Lyndon Baines Johnson, if Robert Kennedy had his way, would not only not be on the 1964 ticket as the vice presidential candidate, but he would go to jail for the corruption that he was involved with.
Although Johnson faced political extinction at the hands of the Kennedys, he had powerful allies with their own agendas that threatened the president, as researcher Gregory Burnham explains.
People would think that he had no enemies. He was so popular. He smiled. He appeared happy. Everyone loved him worldwide. But what people don't seem to understand is behind the scenes, he was making changes, and he was making them decisively, and he was taking some very, very daring steps. He was committed to pull out of Vietnam. By October, he had signed a document, an SAM 263, to that effect. 1,000 troops home by Christmas, and all personnel out of Vietnam by 1965. But that wasn't very good for the military-industrial complex. His abolishing the Central Intelligence Agency, pulling their teeth, holding them to task, back to why they were originally created by Truman. Their original mandate by law is only to coordinate intelligence, not to create the Bay of Pigs. NSAM 55 told the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff that the CIA no longer can do that, and any military operation has to come directly from them to the president, period. That kind of a document really causes problems.
But Texas was home to Kennedy's most dangerous opponents.
Oil millionaires and billionaires in Texas were petrified of one major factor that John F. Kennedy was considering, cutting the oil depletion allowance. And there was no way they were going to allow that. Essentially, they would save billions of dollars if it stays as it is. It was called a 27.5% oil depletion allowance. John Kennedy thought it was too liberal. One of the key men in this case is Clint Murchison. Clint Murchison is an oil millionaire, owned 500 companies, but he was primarily an oil millionaire. He also controlled Texas, controlled Johnson. His major means of operating and controlling people and influencing people was a little hotel called the Hotel Del Charro in La Jolla, California. It cost $100 a day in the 50s. And at that hotel, he would invite all these powerful, influential people. Richard Nixon would come there. Key lieutenants of Carlos Marcello, the head of the mafia in New Orleans, used to vacation there. J. Edgar Hoover, the head of the FBI, used to vacation there free. Every summer for 10 summers, free.
Another Johnson man with close ties to Murchison was a wealthy Texan called D.H. Byrd.
D.H. Byrd was an underboss for Murchison. He was a Del Charro regular. He owned the Texas School Book Depository. He also founded the Civil Air Patrol, which was a kind of military organization, and Lee Harvey Oswald was a member of the Civil Air Patrol. Another associate of Murchison at the time is Bobby Baker. Bobby Baker's in trouble with the scandals, and he was in all kinds of business deals with Murchison, and many of them were illegal. So Murchison was concerned that Baker and that corruption would lead to his door. And maybe not only would Baker go to jail and Lyndon go to jail, but maybe Murchison would go to jail.
As the forces hostile to Kennedy grew in strength and number, they began to think the unthinkable, assassination. Finally, a new imperative forced their hand.
Lyndon Johnson was in big trouble. The Bobby Baker scandal and the Billy Celeste scandal could destroy Lyndon Johnson's career. Lyndon Johnson would go to jail, and he was their man. He represented all these right-wing forces. There was an urgency to kill President Kennedy. They had to save Lyndon Johnson. The governor of Texas, first of all, is Lyndon Johnson's best friend in history. They went back decades together. In the 1948 vote scandal, John Connally was every much a part of that cover-up that took place. He was his campaign manager. It is without question John Connally who entices John F. Kennedy to Texas. Once they get him there, then they're in control of everything. Motorcade routes, the evidence, the Dallas police, everything. It's their land. It's their territory. Lyndon Johnson and his Texas cronies suckered President Kennedy to Texas.
The late Madeline Brown gained a unique insight into Johnson's role in Kennedy's assassination. She first met LBJ in 1948 at the Adolphus Hotel in downtown Dallas, when he was celebrating his election to the Senate following the infamous Box 13 scandal.
I went, I was very young, and it was wonderful. Our relationship developed immediately. Lyndon gave another campaign party in Austin. It was 3 weeks after I met him at the Adolphus, and it was scheduled at the Driscoll Hotel. And, oh, it was so great to see him. I mean, for 3 weeks I had thought about him and how wonderful it was. We were dancing that night, and he says, I'll see you upstairs. And he put a key in my hand. I still have that key. It was exciting. I felt naughty, but I felt good. I fell deeply in love with him. Yes, I did. I was just the other woman in his life, and my emotions are still the same for him as they were when I met him as a very young girl, but I'll always love him. He was the father of my son, Stephen.
That intimate relationship with Johnson continued for many years. Through him, she became familiar with the closed world of power politics in Texas. On the eve of Kennedy's assassination, she attended a party at this house in North Dallas, the family home of oil billionaire Clint Murchison Sr. There was an extraordinary guest list that night.
We had H.L. Hunt, Murchison, Lyndon Johnson made an appearance. We had Hoover. We had Richard Nixon. They were the most influential people there. But I was under the impression that since J. Edgar Hoover was there, that it was to honor Hoover rather than anything else. When Lyndon came in, no one was expecting him. So when Lyndon arrived at Clint Murchison's, they all went into a conference room, and you could just feel the atmosphere. And when Lyndon came out, I was, of course, happy to see him. I did not know that he was going to be there. And he whispered in my ear at that time, those blank-de-blank Kennedys will never embarrass me again. That's no threat. That's a promise. So he departed. The party rapidly broke up after Lyndon departed.
A seamstress and companion, Mae Newman, provides confirmation that this party took place at the Murchison family home on the eve of the assassination. She lived and worked in another Murchison house in Dallas for Virginia, Clint Sr.'s second wife. She speaks here for the first time.
I started working for Virginia Murchison in 1962 until her death in 1997, approximately 36 years. I remember well the night before the assassination. I worked with a man called Jewel Pfeiffer, black man, which was Virginia Murchison's chauffeur. He got a call from her stepson, John, at the big house. They were having a big party for a very special guest that was coming from Washington to go to the party, by the name of Bulldog, which I found out later was J. Edgar Hoover. And he said he was very excited about doing this, going on this trip out to the airport to take this special guest to a very special party, big party. And I asked him when he came back if he got a good tip, and he said no, and he was very, very upset. He had to go back that night to take J. Edgar Hoover to the airport to go back to Washington. And he still didn't get a tip.
Further verification of Hoover's presence in Dallas on the eve of the assassination came from a friend of May's who worked at the Murchison family home.
Beulah May Holman, she was the cook at John and Loopy's house, and she wanted me to go help her that night, which I didn't, but I knew she told me she was cooking quail, and I wanted the recipe, so she gave it to me. She said that it was a very important guest by the name of J. Edgar Hoover that was coming, and I should go out and help her so I could get to meet him. If it was a film star, I probably would have gone, but I didn't know who he was. No, not at that time.
Early the next morning, only a few hours before the assassination, Madeline received a phone call from Johnson, who was back in Fort Worth with Kennedy.
Lyndon called me from the Texas Hotel, and he was still irate. I said, Lyndon, about last night, and he went to cursing. He used foul language all the time, and he said, those Kennedys, he repeated, they will never embarrass me again. That's no threat, that's a promise. And I'd like the entire world to know how I personally feel is the fact Lyndon Johnson knew about the assassination and was a part of it.
Dallas was to become forever linked with the murder of the president. But the rich and powerful men who had met in secret the night before had everything to gain from his death. LBJ was fearful of a long prison sentence, J. Edgar Hoover of losing his job, and the oil men of losing millions of dollars. When the shots rang out on Elm Street the next day, those problems were solved. The shock of Kennedy's assassination and its brutality reverberated around the world, but not everyone was grieving.
The mood in the Murchison family home was very joyous and happy for a whole week after, like champagne and caviar flow every day of the week. But I was the only one in that household at the time that felt any grief for his assassination.
After the president's murder, Hoover had absolute control of the cover-up. All the physical evidence relating to the crime was swiftly removed to Washington. From the beginning, Oswald was promoted as the lone nut assassin. But in LBJ's home state, tongues were wagging.
I met Lyndon on New Year's Eve at the Driscoll Hotel in Austin. And the people in Dallas, I mean, everyone was talking about Lyndon Johnson was the cause of the assassination, and it made my heart very heavy. I just couldn't believe that he could be a part of something so bad. So I confronted Lyndon. I said, Lyndon, you've got to tell me, were you part of the assassination? And of course, he had a high temper fit, hit the wall, and he was very irate and angry. And he said, no, I was not, but the oil people, or he called them the fat cats of Texas that I knew, and the intelligence was the cause of the assassination. I am sure Lyndon did not make the plans per se, but he had the key people that he could call to actually do it.
If the head of the FBI and the head of the Secret Service and key lieutenants of those two figures are involved in covering up, plus the President of the United States and all his cronies, you don't need a massive conspiracy to get away with this.
After the assassination, Cliff Carter, Johnson's aide, made repeated calls from the White House to the district attorney in Dallas, Henry Wade. He was instructed to look no further than Oswald for the guilty man. There was no conspiracy. A similar call was made to the Attorney General of Texas, Wagoner Carr.
Then we have Lyndon Johnson himself calling the chief of homicide, Will Fritz, who's really doing the dirt work as far as interrogating Oswald and trying to get to the bottom of this case. He calls him and tells him, you have your man. You have your man. Let it go at that. Lyndon Johnson is trying to control what is going on with the investigation of the assassination of President Kennedy from Washington, D.C., with crucial figures in the case.
The late Dr. Charles Crenshaw experienced the new president's controlling hand. He was in the operating theater at Parkland Hospital with his colleagues, working to save Oswald's life after Jack Ruby had shot him. He was urgently called to the phone in an adjoining office.
I picked up the phone, and it was there I heard this voice like thunder. It stated, "This is the president, Lyndon B. Johnson." And he asked, "How is the accused assassin doing?" I was so startled. The thing that I could say was, "He's holding his own. He's lost a large amount of blood." He said, "Would you take a message to the chief operating surgeon?" It was more of an order than a question. So I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "There is a man in the room. I would like for him to take a deathbed confession." And all of a sudden, the phone went off. I returned to the operating room. I tapped Dr. Shires on the shoulder. He looked at me like, "What are you talking about?" Everyone was working feverishly in the abdomen trying to correct the wounds there. I said, "Guess who I've been talking to?" I said, "The President of the United States called and wants that man over there to take a deathbed confession." And Shires looked at me like I was crazy. And we both realized that there was no way Lee Harvey Oswald, had he survived, would have been able to give any testimony until 2 or 3 days after the procedure. But still in all, the president had called and I did relay the message.
When Dr. Crenshaw published his story in 1992, he suffered an avalanche of criticism. It was argued that Johnson made no such call. Crenshaw's critics were proved wrong by a former chief switchboard operator at Parkland Hospital, Phyllis Bartlett.
The call came in and said, "Hold the line for the president." And for a second, I couldn't, you know, I was still thinking Kennedy, and I was kind of taken back for a minute, and then in a few seconds, it was just a matter of a second that he came on in a loud voice. He said, "This is Lyndon Johnson. Connect me to the accused assassin's doctor." It sounded the same as it had been on newscasts when I would hear him speak. I knew I had put a call to the operating room, so I contacted Dr. Crenshaw and I told him, that I knew he did get the call, and that I was sorry that the people had, in the newspaper and on the TVs, had tried to discredit him. And that was when I spoke out.
From the moment he became president, Johnson had authority over every aspect of the cover-up of Kennedy's murder. He was unassailable.
Johnson has the power to contain the investigation, both nationally and locally, on the ground in Texas. More so than if it had happened, let's say, in Oregon or Wisconsin, Texas. He's got the power to give the CIA what it wants as president, as opposed to Kennedy, who they feared. He's got the power to take the National Security Action Memorandum that Kennedy had signed in November 1963, tear it up, reverse it, and create a war where 3 million soldiers wound up going to Vietnam instead of 16,000 being brought home by JFK. He can make J. Edgar Hoover director of the FBI for life. He's the man in the middle. The only person that can answer all of the questions of who's at risk, who's going to gain the most, who wins in this deal, there's only one answer to that question, and that's Lyndon Johnson. And his ticket out was Elm Street.
One of the most compelling pieces of evidence linking Johnson with the assassination is through his henchman Malcolm Wallace, the convicted killer of Douglas Kinzer. In the hours following the assassination, on the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository building by the southeast corner window, the Dallas police discovered an unidentified fingerprint.
The fingerprint, the fingerprint, is the ultimate part of the Mack Wallace story. The FBI fingerprinted every Texas School Book Depository employee, including the women employees that worked downstairs, never handled the boxes. They fingerprinted every Dallas officer that was in the sniper's nest so that they could remove those fingerprints from consideration. At the end of the day, you have one fingerprint remaining. It sits in the National Archives for 35 years, until 1998. An investigator takes it to a highly qualified, certified latent print examiner, a CLPE, along with a redacted fingerprint card from Mack Wallace from the 1951 murder of John Douglas Kinzer. And he said, here's a print, here's a print card. Do you see anything?
Nathan Darby is one of the most experienced fingerprint experts in the United States, with 35 years service in the U.S. military and the City of Austin Police Department.
I didn't know where it came from, and a week or 10 days later, I called the party and that had brought it over and said, well, it's a match. The finger that made the ink print also made the latent, and we call that a match or identified. And there was no question about it. They matched.
3 years later, Nathan Darby readdressed the same evidence and reconfirmed his original findings.
When he was done, he had a 34-point match. And when you mention that in criminal circles to an investigator, how confident would you feel with a 34-point match? Oh, that's a slam dunk. It can't miss. It doesn't get any better than that. You give me a 34-point match on any case in the United States, I'll take it to court and win.
The inked and the latent print are made by the same finger. And the other evidence that I've been presented with was Malcolm Wallace's left little finger, without a reasonable doubt.
Now, the fingerprint in question came from a cardboard box in the sniper's nest in the Texas School Book Depository. Fingerprints do not last long on cardboard. So it's fair to say that either Malcolm Wallace was wandering around there for no purpose, he was in that sniper's nest on November 22nd. That evidence, that fingerprint evidence, along with Malcolm Wallace's sordid resume, was sent to every imaginable agency or individual that could have an interest in what happened to John Kennedy. The only people that took notice of it were the Dallas police, because it's still an open homicide on their blotter. And they took serious notice of it. And then they were told, forward it up the line, because Dallas no longer has any evidence. It's all in federal hands, even though it's an unsolved homicide. They forwarded it up the line. And it took 18 months, for the FBI to say verbally, no, it's not a match. And the single most important fingerprint found in the last 35 years was buried.
I don't know why they couldn't say that the thing didn't match. It did match. There's no question about it. My experience, I've just had too much experience. I know what I'm talking about. I'm positive. No question about it. My dying declaration, if I was to drop dead right now, they match.
It's still the big lie. It's unknown. It's unidentified. No, it's identified. It's Malcolm Wallace, and he's linked to Estes, Carter, and Lyndon B. Johnson directly.
According to the official record, Malcolm Wallace died in a single car accident on this lonely stretch of Texas highway on the night of January 7th, 1971. There were no witnesses. His body was taken to a local hospital where he was pronounced dead. He was buried here, close to other family members. 8 months later, another key member of LBJ's inner circle, presidential aide Cliff Carter, died unexpectedly. But shortly before his death, he met with Billy Solestes.
They discuss all these murders that Cliff Carter is knowledgeable about. Now, Billy knows about some of them, but Cliff knows about more, and he fills them in on all the details. Malcolm Wallace being a central figure in most of these murders. And there were over 17 murders that Carter tells Estes about. And he actually tells Estes that he fears for his own life. And within 2 days' time, he's dead.
Johnson's attorney, Edward Clark, was one person who prospered. But when LBJ was brought low by the Vietnam War and decided not to run for a second term, Clark felt shortchanged for his role in the assassination, according to his legal partner, Barr McClellan.
He expected $8 million spread over 8 years, over the two terms Johnson was to serve.
When those terms were cut short by Johnson's sudden and unexpected resignation, Clark was $4 million short. He was not a man to be denied. When he had done a service, he was going to be paid. Planning ahead, he went to Big Oil and Big D, went to Clint Murchison to say, look, I've done y'all a great service. I deserve more. I'm going to get it. Murchison agreed with him and suggested he file for a well in the middle of the Great East Texas oil field. He called me in as his personal attorney to make the first bid for getting that money, and he was not successful in getting $4 million, but he got his $2 million. So when all was said and done, Clark realized $6 million for the assassination of John Kennedy.
Bar McClellan believes documentary proof of these dark deeds lies in the Johnson-Clark legal records. For many years, they were kept in a high security area above the Clark offices, known as the penthouse.
Any of us attorneys could get into the general area, but the secret area, the Johnson area, was locked off, accessible to no one. I have a strong belief that there are substantial records somewhere that show this conspiracy and its both evolution, its execution, and its cover-up. But I don't know where they'd be. We need to see them.
Johnson was ultimately consumed by the high office he had so unscrupulously striven for. A broken man, he retreated to his Texas ranch, where his lawyers were to secretly summon a psychiatrist to deal with his deepening depression.
An immediate concern at the law firm was that he would say too much. The $1 million was available to the psychiatrist to keep anything from coming out. The one reason for all these protections was the greatest demon that was dogging Johnson at the time, and that was the assassination of John Kennedy and the role he played in it. We had to keep it covered up, and for sure we had to keep the psychiatrist muzzled, and we did. But if any one set of records needs to be produced, the psychiatric records should be disclosed to the American public, because they will, I am confident, disclose his role in the assassination.
Only 4 years after leaving office, Johnson died. But there are those living who are still afraid to come forward to tell what they know about the guilty men.
People are afraid of him dead. He's been dead since 1973, and his shadow still casts fear in this country, especially in Texas.
Undaunted, across the nation, the questioning voice of the American people will not be silenced. An overwhelming majority refused to accept their government's version of what happened in Dallas on November the 22nd, 1963.
There's no statute of limitations on murder. If they're still continuing to cover it up in 20 more years, that's obstruction of justice. It's a conspiracy. The men who killed Kennedy don't end with the people who pulled triggers. It should be important to all of us that we get to the bottom of this.
Just as John Kennedy's car took an incredible turn when it went onto Elm Street, 300 feet later, our form of government, our way of life, our way of respecting our government, our way of being respected by our government, took that same kind of bizarre wide turn, and we haven't gotten back on the straight and narrow yet.
The Kennedy assassination was the end of faith in government. And so it's up to the little man to fight the odds. Davy Crockett, Sisyphus pushing his rock. Someone has to keep fighting the odds. And even though you know the chances are that you're never going to get a resolution to what you're fighting for, you have to fight for it anyway. Just the principle of justice. Just the principles of American democracy. Don't give up. Keep fighting.
I've been looking at history, and I've been impressed and depressed by the fact that history is really a chronicle of immense atrocities. What we have in history is the fact that when surplus value develops, when there's more than a subsistence economy, you have some portion of the population that will do everything it can to enslave and to expropriate the labor of the rest of the people. Whether it's a slave society, as in ancient Greece and Rome, or feudal society where people were reduced to serfs, or in a capitalist society where people are driven to the edge of insecurity and made to work faster and harder. And one of the things that's used in that arrangement is a very conscious instrument of control that's very necessary. And that instrument is called the state. That is, what they do is set up a state, an organization that has a, as Max Weber, who wasn't a Marxist, as Max Weber called it, an organization that has a monopoly on the legitimate uses of force and violence, on the use of legitimate force and violence. But that's what we have today. We also have developed in modern times some democratic features, some means of trying to fight back and restrain this arbitrary power. What am I trying to say? That along with government, we also have a thing called the state. And along with governance, along with policies, and along with those things, we have this other instrument, even in a democratic state. And that instrument, whether it's in democratic France, or democratic England, or democratic Germany, or democratic Italy, or democratic USA, or democratic Canada, and all these countries, all of them have these other instruments and agencies that act like a bunch of gangsters, that act repressively, that use surveillance, that use every dirty trick in the book, unequal enforcement of tax laws, name it. The bringing in of drugs into whole neighborhoods and communities, trumped up murder charges, assassination. And that you have in the middle of these democracies, you have the state within the state known as the national security state. And that state is capable of the most unspeakable crimes that you can think of. And those crimes are perpetrated against their own people. They're perpetrated against people all around the world. Not long ago, I got a letter from a woman who's been a community organizer in Chicago. And she said with grief in her heart, she said, I remember the 60s. I remember the tremendous democratic organization and leadership that was developing in the Latino and African-American communities. And I remember those leaders, and every single one of them today is either dead, shot by the police, or in Marion prison on trumped up charges. And I remember the demoralization that took place, the shattering of those organizations. And after those organizations were shattered and demoralized, then in came the drug traffickers. And those drug traffickers, the thing I remember the most about them is that they were aided and abetted by the feds, by the federal agents themselves. And this is what happens. That is, we are dealing with a state that was engaged in domestic counterinsurgency, and it was more interested in having a population that was unorganized and demoralized than a population that was organized, that was effectively fighting for its democratic rights. Because if it's organized and it's effective and it's powerful, it will start making demands and start pursuing its interests, and it will start cutting in on the interests that those police and those coppers and those undercover people and those forces of military and law and order are dedicated to protecting the status quo, protecting those with property against those who don't have it. And by the way, for the last 1,000 years, we've had theorists who've made that point, except they make it proudly. Adam Smith said, as the divisions of property become increasingly unequal, it is more and more necessary to have a state to defend those who have property from those who do not. John Locke, the purpose of the state is to defend those who have property from those who do not. James Harrington, you can go on, James Madison, Alexander Hamilton. The only difference is that when Marx said it, he said to defend those who have property from those whose labor is expropriated by those who accumulate wealth off their labor, who have all the property. He changed it a little bit. And he said it wasn't just haves and have-nots, it was haves taking it from those who produced it and created the haves. And throughout the world, dominant economic interests today have enlisted the efforts of assassins and torturers. As we talk at this moment, the CIA and other such agencies in this country and other countries have sponsored violence, torture, death squads, drugs, in scores of countries, from Zaire to Angola to Mozambique to El Salvador to Guatemala to Indonesia to East Timor, and you go on and on and on, all through to Western Europe, to the USA, to Chicago and Detroit and Boston and New York. They have systematically targeted in many countries the clergy, the peasant leaders, intellectuals, journalists, student leaders, labor union leaders, workers, and any community activists and such. Tens of thousands have been murdered and assassinated to prevent social change, to destroy any kind of redistributive politics, any kind of government, any kind of social movement that is not willing to reduce its people to economic fodder. And with NAFTA, with the North American Free Trade Agreement, we now see the third worldization of the USA will continue full speed ahead. The gangster nature of the state is cloaked by the democratic facade and by the democratic substance of the government. I mean, there is some democratic substance there. Democratic victories have been won. We have struggled, and certain things have been won. And yet, in the midst of this, this state still goes on. And what is so compelling about an issue like drugs, as Michael Levine is pointing out, is that it's not that we're saying the government is not doing enough about drugs, or they were losing the war against drugs. It's that the government or elements in it are active perpetrators and purveyors of drugs. And what it is so compelling about the JFK assassination is how nakedly the gangster nature of the state is revealed. It is an awakening. And to know the truth about the JFK assassination is to create a delegitimating force that calls into question the entire state system and the entire social order it represents. And this is why for 30 years, the mainstream press has suppressed or dismissed out of hand the findings about JFK's death. The findings of independent investigators like Peter Dale Scott, Harold Weisberg, Carl Oglesby, Mark Lane, Anthony Summers, Philip Melanson, Jim Garrison, Cyril Wecht, and dozens of others. They're called assassination buffs. They're not buffs. Even that word is a limiting and marginalizing and diminishing term. A buff is a kind of a hobby pursuer, you see. It's a kind of a quirky person who follows quirky little interests. Would you talk about Holocaust buffs, would you? No. They are serious investigators of a very serious crime, which leads to all sorts of serious understandings about the criminal nature of the state. And this is why they relentlessly, the mainstream media and the opinion leaders and the political leaders of this country, relentlessly attack or ignore this literature. And this is why they give fulsome, gushing, ready publicity to the likes of Gerald Posner with his book Case Closed, which got put into every major magazine. I couldn't put the TV on all week without seeing this guy's face and hearing him blather these kind of cliche statements whose credibility are dependent on you being totally ignorant of what the investigators for 30 years have been uncovering and the questions that have been raising. And who did a grotesque, idiotic whitewash of the whole thing. And this is why they savaged Oliver Stone's movie, JFK. A movie that was very accurate about the specifics of the murder. A movie that reached millions of people, that broke through that thing that they were keeping down. The only movie in the history of Hollywood, and I wrote a book called Make Believe Media, which is about TV and film, so I think I know something about films. At least I did spend the better part of a year reading a lot of literature. It's the only movie that I know of that was attacked 6 months before it was ever released. In the Washington Post and in the New York Times and in Time and Newsweek, and attacked relentlessly for a year after it was released. And this is also why in this past week they kept up the relentless propaganda campaign with the 30th anniversary of the Kennedy assassination to show that Oswald was the lone assassin. And they're always limiting the question, just as the Warren Commission did a priori, was Oswald the lone assassin? Did he act alone? Did he or did he not act alone? Meanwhile, all the serious investigators have a different question. It's not that he was not at all one of the people who shot Kennedy. He did not act at all, although he was involved in another way. He was involved as a fall guy. And this is why they do this. If you want to know why, you just listen to them. It's not my analysis, it's what they say. The propagandists of the right and the center know why they've got to trash this issue and contain it. Listen to what Tom Wicker of the New York Times had to say. Now, Tom Wicker, he's never written a movie review in his life. JFK came out, and Tom Wicker, who is a columnist, a Washington columnist for the New York Times, suddenly became a movie reviewer. And instead of getting the usual movie review length of 800 words, he got 2,000 words. It's a whole page with pictures and all that. And in that review, he tells us that if the, quote, wild assertions in Oliver Stone's movie are taken at face value, Americans will have to accept the idea that most of the nation's major institutions conspired together and carried out Kennedy's murder. In an era, Wicker goes on, in an era when mistrust of government and loss of confidence in institutions, the press not the least, are widespread and virulent, such a suggestion seems a dubious public service. So truth or not truth has nothing to do with it. He's saying the question is institutional legitimacy. Wicker understands the heart of the matter. A full revelation about the murder would be a serious attack upon the legitimacy of the dominant institutions of state and class, the press not being the least of one of those institutions, a faithful servant of it. The system that New York Times writers faithfully defend. Playing before mass audiences, the movie JFK did not finger a cabal of malevolent perpetrators, but in fact pointed the finger at the national security state itself as the murderer. Damage control. You know, back in 1978, the House Select Committee reported, in fact, after an investigation, that there was more than one assassin shooting Kennedy. And there, therefore, was a conspiracy. In response, the Washington Post immediately editorialized in 1978, quote, "Could it have been some other malcontent whom Mr. Oswald met casually?" It gets better. With. "Could not as many as three or four societal outcasts with no ties to any one organization have developed in some spontaneous way a common determination to express their alienation in the killing of President Kennedy? It is possible that two persons acting independently attempted to shoot the president at the very same time. It is possible. It's not at all likely." So sometimes those who deny conspiracies create the most convoluted fantasies of all. David Garrow, who wrote a biography of Martin Luther King, benignly, patronizingly looks at you, at the public mind, and he says that the evidence pointing to a conspiracy to murder Martin Luther King, a large majority of the American people do believe in assassination conspiracies. That allows events to have large, mysterious causes instead of small, idiosyncratic ones. I would say the Washington Post had the most mysterious cause of all a few minutes ago. They like that. They like the large causes. You see, but the question of conspiracy, it has to be decided by an investigation of evidence, not by a priori, unscientific, and patronizing presumptions about the public mind. In any case, the evidence in King's assassination doesn't involve large, mysterious causes, but very immediate actualities. And the investigators, like Peter Dale Scott and Harold Weisberger and Mark Lane, they weren't impelled by some yearnings, you see. They were impelled by questions of evidence, by things that didn't just seem to make sense, by very immediate empirical things which drew them into this more and more. But which these people who never read that evidence don't have to deal with, and so they can fashion all these theories. The independent investigators demolished the Warren Commission. The first and most effective, perhaps, was Harold Weisberg's book, Whitewash, and then the other one by Mark Lane, Rush to Judgment. Right there, terrific, written 25 years ago. Let's focus on a small part of the actual conspiracy. I can't obviously go through it all. It would take ages. Let's start with Oswald. If you watch television this week, you again, for the 78th time, heard that Oswald was a loner, an incompetent, not very bright. You heard he was emotionally disturbed. Gerald Posner got on there, turning instant psychiatrist, and he said, Lee Harvey Oswald was a very disturbed young boy. He had a very disturbed childhood, and he was a passive aggressive. I said, a passive aggressive? A passive aggressive assassin? How does that? That explains why he used a rifle which couldn't shoot straight. He also was a leftist. Alexander Coburn has joined the right and the center, and in a column in the Examiner said he was a leftist. The truth is something else. Lee Harvey Oswald, all his IQ tests show that he was above average intelligence. He was a bright guy, a quick learner. Lee Harvey Oswald spent most of his adult life not as a lonely drifter, but directly linked to the U.S. intelligence community. At the age of 18 in the U.S. Marines, he had secret security clearance, and he was working at Marine Air Control in Atsugi Base in Japan. Atsugi was a top secret base where the CIA launched some of its U-2 flights and did other kinds of covert operations in China. The next year, at the age of 19, he was assigned to El Toro Air Station in California with security clearance to work radar. And here he emerged, certain strange things began to happen. He emerged as a babbling Russophile and Soviet communist. He started playing Russian language records at blast level in his barracks. He started addressing his fellow Marines in Russian. He read Russian books and touted Soviet communism as, quote, the best system in the world. He called his fellow Marines comrades. Now, the U.S. Marine Corps in 1958 was not exactly known as a bastion of liberal tolerance and free thinking. My buddy Bernard Livingston wrote a book called Closet Red. He tells of his experiences in the Army where they had to filter out anybody who had funny opinions, who had pinko-ish opinions or whatever else, they had to be reported. That the Army constantly, and I'm sure the Marines, constantly surveils anybody who might outspokenly or actively begin to say or act certainly in the way he did. But in this instance, Oswald's Marine commanders didn't mind. He kept his security clearance. He kept all the radar records. He could see what was going in and out and knew all about the things that were happening there. And he had a wealth of sensitive radar information and other highly sensitive information from sensitive bases, black operations as they were called. Well, if Oswald was a Soviet spy or a Cuban spy, as some people now claim, he certainly had a novel way of building a cover. Other odd things began happening. In February 1959, Lee Harvey Oswald failed the Marine Corps proficiency test in Russian. 6 months later, he was practically fluent in Russian. Only in 1974, a document that was dislodged from the Warren Commission that had been secreted thanks to Howard Weisberg's legal efforts got the document out. It was shown that Oswald had attended the U.S. Army Monterey School of Languages. Now, Monterey is not open to anyone who just happens to have a hobby, a language hobby. You go only for serious training, and you are sent by the government, and it must be related to government work in a language picked by the government, which is related to specific assignments. So Oswald learned Russian at the U.S. Monterey School of Languages. Another odd thing, Oswald was given an early discharge from the Marines because his mother had injured her foot. That's called a dependency discharge. Your parent needs you. A jar had fallen on her toe. And he was immediately, he put in the request and he got it within a week. His fellow Marines were astonished at the velocity of the release. It also so happened that the jar fell on her foot a year before the discharge. But she was having, it wasn't healing right, you know. This was only one of a number of very strangely favorable treatments that the U.S. government began to give Lee Harvey Oswald. He then defected to the USSR. But how? Philip Melanson raises the question. To get to Russia in those days, it would have cost $1,500. Lee Harvey Oswald's bank account showed a deposit of only $203. He got, after he arrived in London and was there, he left London and went to Helsinki on October 11, on a day when there were no available commercial flights that would have allowed him to make it in one day. He had some kind of private transportation to get to Helsinki. In Russia, he announced that he was renouncing his U.S. citizenship and that he had lots of secrets that he was going to give to the Soviets. He even went into the U.S. embassy and announced that and made sure they all knew it. The Soviets didn't bite. They let him stay, but they at no time thought he could be an agent of any use to them. They kept him under constant surveillance. He worked in a factory. He showed no particular interest in guns, but he belonged to the factory's gun club. He used to join in the rabbit shoots, and he could never hit the rabbit. Always someone had to come behind him and shoot the rabbit while he was firing, otherwise they would have been there all day. It was a joke. He was a miserable marksman, as he had been in the U.S. Marines. He had been flagged again and again on the, he missed the whole target a number of times. You get the flag. So Lee Harvey Oswald's show was a, couldn't hit the side of a barn. Now, if Lee Harvey Oswald was really a defector and not a U.S. spy, then U.S. intelligence could well have taken the view that his was one of the most damaging defections in history. Now, what's done in all defections, especially those connected with, definitely those connected with government and military, is that there's a damage assessment. No damage assessment was ever made on Oswald's defection. This did come out in the Warren Commission and the House Select Committee. Why was there was no damage assessment? Guess it was just overlooked. We don't know. After 2.5 years, he applies to return to the U.S. This is after renouncing his citizenship, announcing he was going to give away secrets. And instead of being grabbed when he comes out and tried as a traitor, the U.S. accepts him back. And he says he was never debriefed. In fact, he was debriefed in Holland, in Amsterdam, but the CIA has no record of debriefing him, doesn't know who he is, never touched him, was never near him. And their explanation before the commission was that there were so many tourists coming in and out, that there was nothing particularly about him that would catch our attention. One might wonder, what is needed to catch your attention? A defector, secrets, all that. After the assassination, the CIA claimed that they suspected that he was a Soviet spy. They still didn't debrief him then. That makes it even more curious. He gets out of Russia, and what does the State Department do? They give him money. They give him money to travel back to the U.S. and get set up. They pay all his travel and moving expenses and those of his wife's. He's given back his passport with full rights to travel anywhere and denounce the U.S. government again someplace else. His wife is exempted from usual immigration quotas. No waiting. No exclusion for having belonged to the Soviet Komsomol, which is the Communist Youth Organization, which is a violation of U.S. immigration laws. Yet she was allowed in. Once back in Dallas, Lee Harvey Oswald settles in under the wing of one George Demorenschild, a right-wing Russian with CIA ties. And this begins a whole pattern that goes on in Dallas and New Orleans, namely the forays out into the public eye as a leftist. Once back in Dallas, Lee Harvey Oswald settles in under the wing of one George Demorenschild, a right-wing Russian with CIA ties. And this begins a whole pattern that goes on in Dallas and New Orleans, namely, the forays out into the public eye as a leftist. He starts a one-person Fair Play for Cuba organization in New Orleans, never has another member, never recruits another member. All his time in New Orleans and in Dallas, he never once contacts a single member of the Communist Party or any other left organization. Although he writes lots of letters to the Communist Party USA and to the Socialist Workers Party, two groups which at that time weren't even talking to each other. Say, dear comrades, how are you? We fight forward and we go on. Yes, what should I do? And this and that. Send me instructions, you know. He blazes a trail, local TV, fistfights, inflammatory incidents, leaflets. One of the leaflets shows that his organization was on Camp Street in the very same building that Guy Bannister had his office. Guy Bannister was an FBI agent, and a whole bunch of other Cuban emigre right-wing groups were there. And his personal relations were with right-wing anti-communist Cubans or with right-wing crypto-fascists or CIA types or others. So while he supposedly was this leftist, and if you ever heard any of the tapes of him speaking and explaining what communism was or socialism was, it's laughable. It's this little rote, superficial thing. While he was a leftist, in fact, all his personal associations were with right-wing people linked to the intelligence community. He also knew Jack Ruby. Now, they would have us believe that this man who couldn't hit the side of the barn took a Manlinka Carcana rifle, whose sights were not even set. An Italian weapon, by the way, which the Italians said, the weapon that never killed anyone on purpose. And he fired and killed the President of the United States. That he would forego shooting President Kennedy when he had a full body shot of him coming right at him down Houston Street, right toward the Texas Book Depository, where he could go at him like a shooting gallery that's coming closer and closer. Perfect, the ideal thing. He didn't shoot him then. He waited until the car turned at a 110-degree angle down Elm Street, and as he went by and had only his head and a little portion of his shoulders, and then firing through the trees, he rapidly got off 3 shots in a few seconds, something which the best marksmen in the country were not able to emulate until after much practice and after the sights on the Manlinka Carcana were reset and brought into a laboratory and fixed in there. And they had all sorts of remarks to make about the awful performance of this rifle. By the way, right through a tree that was later cut down. We are asked to believe that a bullet would go through John Kennedy, pose in midair for 2 seconds, change directions, and wound Governor Connally in 2 places, and then reappear intact on a stretcher fallen out of Connally's body. By the way, that's not true. It did not ever reappear on the stretcher as if fallen out of somebody's body. It had reappeared wedged into the side of the stretcher. It obviously had been pushed in there. So this was a bullet that jumped out of Connally's body and wedged itself in the side of the stretcher. This magic bullet had a lot of magic in it. We're asked to believe that a treasure of physical evidence, the interior of the limousine, the presidential limousine itself, which would have all sorts of evidence, bits of shrapnel, whatever else, from bullet parts, blood, lines of fire, which was just accidentally taken, instantly torn out, destroyed, and totally rebuilt. That this was not a deliberate cover-up. But we're asked to believe that Kennedy's brain just disappeared. That the x-ray, which now shows a reconstructed head with no exit wound, is oddly taken with no jaw. So it could be anybody's. You can't do any kind of dental identification to see if that x-ray is President Kennedy's. That the autopsy was just botched innocently. We're asked to believe that Jack Ruby, a gambler and gangster with links to the Cuban exiles and an acquaintance of Oswald's, who once worked for Congressman Richard Nixon for the House and American Activities Committee in Chicago when his name was still Jack Rubenstein, before he changed it to Ruby, were asked to believe that he just took it upon himself to kill Oswald because he was so moved by the suffering that Oswald had caused the Kennedy family. Although Ruby, a year later in jail, repeatedly kept alluding to the fact that you don't know the whole story. There's much more behind all of this. There's something really deep and sinister here and all this. And he was just simply dismissed by a media that was taking its cues. We're asked that the 21 witnesses, persons otherwise related to the case in some close way, with some information, privy to some conversations or whatever else, all who've met violent deaths were part of a colossal coincidence, like the one the Washington Post was talking about. That later on in 1978, the second round of killings that started after the House Select Committee investigation, 16 more who died violently, they just happened to die coincidentally, violent deaths, including one of them being George de Morenchild himself, killed by a gun blast to the head 3 hours after a House Assassinations Committee investigator had tried to contact him. He was being set up for an interview. He was being set up for a lot more than that. George Morenschild was not only close to Oswald, but in his telephone book there was found an insert to George Pappy Bush, that he was a close friend of George Bush, and there was a correspondence between them. The sheriff's office in Palm County, Florida, found that his shooting was very strange, and it was ruled a suicide. William Sullivan, a third guy in the FBI, who was supposed to appear before the House committee to talk. By the way, Sullivan was on CIA, according to Robert Murrow, he was on the CIA payroll. He was shot right outside his home by a man who claimed to have mistaken him for a deer. He was charged with misdemeanor and released in custody of his father, a state policeman. Sam Giancano, who died from natural causes when his heart stopped beating after a bullet went through it. One day before he was to testify about mob and CIA connections, while under government protection. And by the way, what comes out of this whole thing is the incredible linkages between the CIA and mob families and mob figures again and again. Because after all, the mob is very functional. They can do the kind of dirty things that that the CIA may sometimes want them to do. There are even some on the left, like Noam Chomsky and Alexander Coburn, who argue that this whole interest in the assassination comes from a Kennedy revival, a Camelot yearning, the yearning for a lost messiah. I'm giving quotes. These are quotes right from Chomsky. Coburn and Chomsky and others, they challenge the notion that Kennedy was assassinated for intending to withdraw from Vietnam or undo the CIA or end the Cold War. These things could not have led to his downfall because they were not true. Kennedy was a Cold Warrior, a counterinsurgent who wanted a military withdrawal from Vietnam only with victory. I have argued similarly in my book, Democracy for the Few, that in fact, indeed, Kennedy was a Cold Warrior and a counterinsurgent, and that he should not be romanticized as a progressive. Chomsky, Coburn, and others claim that the change of administration that came with JFK's assassination had no large-scale effect on policy, not even on tactics. In other words, if Kennedy had lived, he likely would have fabricated a Tonkin Gulf casus belli. He would have introduced ground troops in a massive land war, as Lyndon Johnson did. He would have engaged in the merciless B-52 carpet bombings of Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam, as Richard Nixon did. He would have risked destroying his own electoral base, proving himself a mass murderer as bad as Nixon. Chomsky and Coburn don't tell us how they know that. All we know is the one surviving Kennedy, the Robert Kennedy, in fact, went a different way. He became an anti-war critic, he opposed the war, he broke with the Johnson administration, and he said that his brother's administration, his administration, had committed terrible mistakes. The evidence we do have, in fact, is that John Kennedy observed Cambodian neutrality and negotiated a ceasefire and coalition government in Laos, which the CIA refused to honor. They preferred to back a right-wing faction that continued the war. Chomsky says much about troop withdrawal. He just wrote a whole book on this, Camelot Revisited and all that. But he says very little about troop escalation, other than to offer Roger Hilsman's speculation that Kennedy might well have introduced U.S. troops, ground troops in South Vietnam. Maybe so, maybe not. In fact, the same Hilsman noted in the New York Times not long ago, and Chomsky doesn't note it, that in 1963, Kennedy was the only person in his administration who opposed the introduction of U.S. ground troops. He was the only thing preventing an escalation of the war. Forget the question of withdrawal or not withdrawal. He was a barrier in that sense. Whether or not there are certain left analysts who think Kennedy was or wasn't a progressive or a liberal and thinks that the CIA had no reason to kill him or other people had no reason to be dissatisfied with him, the fact is, do they see it that way? You know, entrenched interests are notorious for not seeing the world the same way that left analysts do. In 1963, people in right-wing circles, including elements in various intelligence organizations, did not believe that Kennedy could be trusted with the nation's future. Now, some months ago on a San Francisco talk show, I heard a guy come on. It was on KGO, and he said, "I've never said this before. I never said it. It's the first time I'm saying it. But I worked for Army Intelligence. And in 1963, I was in Japan, and the accepted word around then was that Kennedy would be killed because he was messing too much with the intelligence community. And when word came of his death, we were, all I could hear were delighted comments like, "We got the bastard." What JFK's enemies saw something, was what they saw was something different from what Chomsky and Coburn have seen. They fixed on Kennedy's refusal to provide air coverage, the Bay of Pigs, his refusal to go in with U.S. forces, his unwillingness to launch another invasion of Cuba, his no invasion guarantee to Khrushchev on Cuba, his atmospheric test ban treaty with Moscow, his American University speech calling for a reexamination of our Cold War attitudes toward the Soviet Union, his unwillingness to send ground forces in a massive form into Vietnam, his antitrust suit against General Electric, his fight with U.S. Steel over price increases, his challenge to the Federal Reserve Board, his warm reception at labor conventions, his call for racial equality and responsiveness to civil rights leaders, reluctant responsiveness, his talk of moving forward in a new frontier. Erwin Knoll, the progressive, says that he admits he has no idea who killed Kennedy, but this doesn't keep him from asserting that the Oliver Stone film was manipulative and that Stone provided false answers. How do you know that, Erwin, if you have no idea who killed Kennedy? And the remarkable thing about Erwin Knoll and Noam Chomsky and Alexander Coburn is they don't know a damn thing about the criticisms and investigation that's been made. We've said this again and again. In the rebuttals in the exchange in the Nation, almost every one of them said, Alexander Coburn doesn't know anything about this case. He doesn't know anything about Lee Harvey Oswald, really. He doesn't know just some of the questions I brought up. They don't know anything. And they never deny it. They never say anything. They go on with their patronizing comments. Well, Chomsky, patronization and condescension, Coburn with vitriol and venom. They go on attacking those who supposedly are idealizing Kennedy. Erwin Knoll shows he's flexible, though. He says he allows that the Warren Commission did a hasty, slipshod job of investigation. I disagree. The commission did a brilliant job of investigation. It sat for 51 long sessions over a period of several months, much longer than most major investigations. It compiled 26 volumes of testimony and evidence. It had the investigative resources of the FBI and CIA at its command. Far from being hasty and slipshod, it painstakingly crafted theories that moved toward its foreordained conclusion that Oswald was the assassin. It framed an argument and moved unfailingly to fulfill that argument. It failed to call witnesses who saw something different from what it wanted to hear, who not only heard, but who saw people on the grassy knoll shooting. It failed to call them. It ignored or reinterpreted what little conflicting testimony that did creep into its proceedings. All this took deliberate effort. It was carefully crafted, painstakingly. A hasty, slipshod investigation would show traces of randomness in its errors. Some would go this way, some would go that way. But the commission's distortions consistently move in the same direction in pursuit of a prefigured hypothesis. The gullible U.S. public that Erwin Knoll talks about. Knoll condemns Oliver Stone for playing on the gullibility of the American people. See, he's not gullible. He's cool. He doesn't fall for this. He's so cool he didn't even go see the movie. You see, the U.S. public has not bought the official explanation. 78% say they believe there was a conspiracy. And both Chomsky and Coburn in The Nation, Chomsky in Z Magazine, and again in a letter in exchange with me, both of them dismiss that fact and point out the same identical analog. They point out that, in fact, over 70% of the people also believe in miracles. So, what does that prove? And what has that got to do with the question at hand? That people can have a stupid opinion about one thing doesn't mean they're stupid about everything. In fact, Chomsky and Coburn are themselves evidence of that. In any case, the comparison is between two different things. They're comparing the public's gullibility about miracles with the public's unwillingness to be gullible about the official line of it being fed and shoved in their faces for 30 years. That's not gullibility at all. Alexander Coburn and Noam Chomsky have told us that we must not reduce great developments in history to conspiracy, for then we lose sight of institution, class, and other systemic factors of American capitalism. I don't need them to tell me about systemic factors in American capitalism. I use a structural analysis in all my writings. But investigating the JFK conspiracy, we are not looking for an escape from something unpleasant and difficult. That's psychiatrist Noam Chomsky speaking. But we're hitting upon the nature of state power in what is supposedly to be a democracy.
Conspiracy is not something that's in contradistinction to structural analysis. It is part of it. These guys will use conspiracy. They will use legitimacy. They will finance elections. They will use publicity campaigns. They will set up liberalish organizations. They will set up alternative trade union movements. They will use assassins and death squads. They will use every single conceivable thing there is. And this was one of the things they used. When they had someone who was giving them trouble, when they had someone who was standing in their path because he was a little too bright and too shiny, when they had an agenda to save Southeast Asia from communism, they would kill one of their own. And that is a tremendous revelation. It was a startling revelation to the American public to make them realize what kind of a gangster government and national security state we really have in this country and what it does around the world. A structuralist position should not discount the role of human agency in history. Institutions are not self-generating forces. The great continuities of corporate and class interests, that's Coburn's phrase, do not happen of their own accord like reified, disembodied social forces. Neither empires nor national security institutions come into existence in a fit of absent-mindedness. Although the British elites used to say that, the British Empire was accumulated in a fit of absent-mindedness. Give me a break, as these guys plotted and killed and brought armies in and destroyed and bribed and murdered and lied and did all the things and plundered these countries and plundered them. Absent-minded? God knows when you focus your attention what you would do. There's a conscious interest being pursued here, and the evidence for it is the state itself. These things, these events are created by willfully intended policymakers who pursue specific interests. It is the essence of the state and the function of state institutions to act as conscious agents in recreating the conditions of politico-economic hegemony. That's what it's there for. That's what they're paid to do. To achieve their goals, state leaders, especially those within the national security state, will resort to every necessary form of mass manipulation, deception, and violence, even against one of their own, whom they have come to see as a liability. Conspiratorial action is not, brothers and sisters, is not something separate and exclusive of institutional presence. In fact, there's a constant interplay between the two. And by the way, all this call for structural analysis, institutional analysis, where's the institutional analysis in the nation? All you get are conspiracies, inside intrigues, events, happenings, articles that preoccupy with immediate policies, issues, events, personalities, secret deals, all that kind of stuff. All of them of vastly lesser magnitude than JFK assassination. And yet, in 30 years, the nation and the progressive have never published a single word by investigators like Peter Dale Scott and such, except a letter to the editor once in a while. Now, let me quote from Peter's book. Deep Politics. He raises this question of conspiracy, and he points out that G. William Domhoff makes a point very much like Coburn's. He says, and Peter, I think, makes a point very much like the one I made, which I was quoting from, which was in my exchange with Chomsky in Z Magazine, with Chomsky and also in The Nation, in my exchange with Coburn. I made this point that conspiracy and institution are not mutually exclusive. And they never have answered or addressed that point, either to rebut it or to accept it or to see how it doesn't apply here or does apply, whatever. They just ignore it. Domhoff points out, if conspiracy means that these men, meaning the ruling elites, are aware of their interests, know each other personally, meet together privately and off the record, and try to hammer out a consensus on how to anticipate and react to events and issues, then there is some conspiring that goes on in the Council for Foreign Relations, not to mention the Committee for Economic Development, the Business Council, the National Security Council, and the Central Intelligence Agencies. But then Domhoff, Scott goes on to show that Domhoff shares that same kind of resistance that Coburn and Chomsky have to the idea that an assassination conspiracy could have a lasting impact on our political arrangements. We all have a tremendous tendency to want to get caught up in believing that there's some secret evil cause for all of the obvious ills of the world. Conspiracy theories encourage a belief that if we get rid of a few bad people, everything will be well in the world. He's quoting Domhoff. Then Peter answers, I believe that a true understanding of the Kennedy assassination will lead not to a few bad people, but to the institutional and parapolitical arrangements which constitute the way we are systematically governed. The conspiracies I see as operative, in other words, are part of our political structure, not exceptions to it. That's Peter Dale Scott. What the left critics do is that they mistaken the low political value of the victim, JFK, whom they hate and detest. Their big fear is that you're going to like him, with the high political importance of the issue and the implications for democracy, the revelation of the gangster nature of the state. I mean, Captain Alfred Dreyfus, back in 1894, was a conservative militarist. Clemenceau once conjectured that if his name had not been Dreyfus, he would have been an anti-Dreyfusard. Does that mean that the political struggle waged in L'Affaire Dreyfus was a waste of time? The issue was quickly drawn between the right and the left, between those who stood with the army and those who stood with the Republic itself and with justice. The same with Benigno Aquino. Aquino was a member of the privileged class in the Philippines. He promised no great structural changes. He was even more conservative than Kennedy. Does this mean that the Filipino people should have dismissed the conspiracy that led to his assassination as an event of no experience? Say, oh, just another ruling class pig. What do we care? Instead, they used it as ammunition against the hated Marcos regime, as a revelation of what that government was really doing. Archbishop Romero of El Salvador. He was a member of the Salvadoran aristocracy. He could not have made it to the top of the church hierarchy otherwise. When he was ordained, they came with presents. They hugged and kissed him. And the minute he opened up his mouth and made some critical remarks about the war and some favorable remarks about the poor, he was assassinated. I doubt if he hadn't been assassinated, the Salvadoran history would have been much different. Does this mean that solidarity groups in this country and El Salvador should not have tried to make his murder an issue that revealed the homicidal gangster nature of the Salvadoran state? Instead of seizing the opportunity, some left writers condescendingly ascribe a host of mass psychology motivations and emotional needs to those of us who are concerned about the JFK assassination. They psychologize about our illusions, our false dreams, our longings for messiahs and father figures, our inability to face unpleasant realities the way they can. They deliver patronizing admonitions about our conspiracy captivation and Camelot yearnings. They urge us not to escape into fantasy. They are the cognoscenti who guide us and outleft us on the JFK assassination, a subject about which they don't know a goddamn thing and whose significance they will never be able and have not been able to grasp. I have a different name for our interests. It is not JFK worship. It's not Camelot yearnings, as the left critics would say. It's not big evils and conspiracy titillation, as the mainstream media would say. Our interest is born of democratic struggle, a desire to know what is going on, a desire to have rulers who are worthy of our name and the name of democracy. Thank you.